Welcome to Whiskey Cask, the Cask Strength podcast featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie. This is episode number 238 for February 7th, 2010. Coming up in a few minutes.
I'd never actually worked in another distillery. I've never made whiskey before this.
That's Peter Hart, the young distiller at Victoria Spirits in British Columbia. A couple of weeks ago at the Victoria Whiskey Festival, Peter's first batch of single malt spirit impressed critics at just 2 months of age. That's coming up along with the calendar of events, the emails of the week, and the What I'm Tasting This Week department. First, though, let's look at the news. And even though I've been talking about young whiskeys, let's start off with some really old whiskey. Back in November, Al Fastier of the Antarctic Heritage Trust told us about the plans to try and recover some of Sir Ernest Shackleton's 100-year-old whiskey from the ice beneath one of his expedition's huts in Antarctica. This week, Al's team recovered 3 cases of whiskey and 2 cases of brandy from the ice. Al joins me from Scott Base in New Zealand with the details. Give us the good news. What did you find down there?
It was very exciting news. Not only did we find the 2 crates of whiskey that we knew about, but we also had a bonus find, and there was a 3rd crate of whiskey and 2 boxes of brandy. So, a very successful excavation.
Now, what is the condition of the cases that you found? I understand you heard some liquid sloshing around inside, right?
That's correct. So, I mean, some of the crates have been damaged by the ice, I suppose, with the expansion of the ice. The crates have been damaged, but all in all, they're in good condition. And when we removed the boxes from under the huts and lifted them out, we could feel the sloshing of the liquid, which was a very good indicator that there was alcohol in them.
But you've not opened the crates as of yet, right?
Well, there's one top part of a crate that had popped off, and we could look inside in the crate, and we could see the neck of a bottle, and we could see the sealed cork, but then the rest was covered in frozen straw, the packing material. So we couldn't see if there's any contents, but we could see that the cork in the bottle was, or the top of the bottle was intact. So it looks very promising.
Where did you find these additional 3 cases? Were they buried under the 2 that you knew about, or were they buried within the permafrost? Where did you find them?
They were buried behind the 2 known whiskey crates. So when we found the 2 whiskey crates, we didn't want to disturb the area until we removed them. And so they're hidden behind. So it was very interesting. We removed the first 2 crates. And then we could look through the opaque ice and just see the words of on the 3rd crate, and that was very exciting. And then we removed that, and then we found 2 more crates. So they're all located very closely together.
What happens next?
That's a good question. At the moment, the Antarctic Heritage Trust is consulting with experts from around the world to develop a conservation methodology to conserve them, and so we don't want to rush things. So at the moment we've got them frozen down and still in a frozen condition. So they've been removed from under the hut, but we're just keeping them in a cold, stable condition.
And they're still on Antarctica, right?
But that's correct.
How long do you think it'll take to reach a decision about the future of these bottles?
That's a good question. I know it's a high priority for the trust, and we're working at it as fast as possible. So, hopefully we would have a methodology developed within the next month or so, and then move forward then.
Have you talked with Richard Patterson at all since you had the find?
I haven't personally. I've been at the historic sites, the executive director of the Antarctic Heritage Trust has, I understand they've been talking together.
What was it like down there? Because it's sort of a mystery world to those of us who have not been down in Antarctica. What was it like around the hut during this time? I know it's summertime down there, but what are the conditions like?
I was The temperatures were around -5, -10. It was a colder summer than normal, and it's quite a high snow season, so there's quite a bit of snow lying around. So we're camping on site, living in mountain tents, in very basic conditions. And I must say it was very hard work and very intense work removing the boxes from what's under the hut. And we spent 3 days lying on our stomachs in the permafrost to be able to remove them. So very intense work, but it was very rewarding and satisfying to have removed them safely, and to have the bonus find of finding the brandy as well. So it was a great outcome. We had been in the field for 6 weeks. The main focus of the work this season was to work not at Shackleton's hut, but at Scott's hut, and the find really lifted the morale of the team. So it was a real bonus for team morale, for the trust, and for the whiskey lovers of the world. So we couldn't ask for a better outcome.
Did you find anything else that surprised you?
No, we didn't. Well, as part of the process, we did find one pick or a pick head, but other than that, nothing else new.
Okay, I will let you go because I'm sure there are probably going to be a bunch of other calls for you about now, so I know you want to get to some of those. Thank you again so much for doing this. And needless to say, we'll hear more from Al in coming episodes as the story develops. Now, while we're mentioning White and Mackay briefly, last time around I mentioned the charity auctions for Haitian earthquake relief. A week's stay for aid at the Jura Lodge, including travel to Jura and a private distilling session with Willie Tate, went for £5,200, or about $8,100. The Richard Patterson Private Masterclass went for £595, or about $930. In other auction news, McTeers held its winter auction of rare whiskies this week in Glasgow. A rare half-size bottle of Springbank distilled in 1900 sold for £2,200, or $3,400. A 1938 Macallan sold for £1,550, or about $2,400. And a 1964 Beaumont went for just under £2,900, or $4,500. The next McTeers whiskey auction is set for May 5th. Edrington and Barry Brothers and Rudd have been partners for years and agreed to swap some of their whiskey assets this week. Edrington will get ownership of the Cutty Sark blended Scotch brand. It's been supplying the whiskey for Cutty Sark for years. The two had joint ownership of the Glenrothes, but Barry Brothers will get the rights to the Glenrothes brand, while Edrington keeps the distillery. There's a long-term deal in place to supply single malt for the Glenrothes expressions. More new whiskeys to report on. Looks like Ardbeg may be about to release a new limited edition. Reports say it'll be named Roller Coaster, but Ardbeg has not confirmed anything yet. Sister distillery Glenmorangie is making its Sonalta PX expression more widely available. Dr. Bill Lumsden told us about this one last September in episode 217. Sonalta PX has been available only in duty-free stores until now, but a limited number of bottles are now available in general release. I forgot to mention it last time around, but Napaug Castle is releasing a 1994 Master Distillers private selection of its Irish single malt. Just 1,100 bottles will be available. And finally, I've mentioned Taiwan's Cavalan a couple of times in the past few weeks. It's celebrating its fourth year of distilling and first anniversary of release with a special Fino Sherry single cask edition. Just 500 bottles are available. A couple of contests to let you know about now. Jim Beam wants you to help select members of the military to receive trips to several major sporting events throughout the year. You can nominate a service member through the Jim Beam website or Facebook fan page. Diageo's Crown Royal Canadian Whiskey also wants your help in honoring a service member. There are 5 soldiers and sailors featured on the Crown Royal website, and your vote will select one to be honored at the Crown Royal-sponsored NASCAR race at Richmond in May. In fact, the winner will have the race named after them. Now, 3 Brown-Forman brands want to help you fix up your aging recreation room. Old Forester, Canadian Mist, and Early Times are giving away a home entertainment system, and will pick a winner from photos of your old rec rooms. Finally, Chris Morris of Old Forester and Woodford Reserve is the new chairman of the Kentucky Distillers Association for 2010. His constituency is a bit smaller, though. Sazerac has decided to leave the association, which is primarily a lobbying group but also does Bourbon Trail promotion. That means Buffalo Trace and the Tom Moore Distillery in Bardstown will no longer officially be part of the Bourbon Trail. A Buffalo Trace spokesperson said Sazerac decided it was in the company's best interests to chart a course away from the KDA, but gave no specifics. Now let's check the inbox for the emails of the week. Ken Goldenberg in sunny Southern California writes, "Yours is one of the top podcasts I listen to, along with Leo Laporte, the tech guy, on twit.tv. I want to know if you or someone else has put together an iPhone app on whiskeys or all spirits. It would be great to have such an app to carry around when I come across a whiskey I have not heard of or want to look up its taste profiles and ratings on the spot. There are plenty of cocktail and bartending apps, but I have yet to find one for whiskey ratings, etc. Know of any?" Well, Ken, there are a few. Diageo's Classic Malts has released a free malt matcher app that helps pair whiskeys with different foods and suggests whiskeys based on what you already like. It's not a ratings app per se, but it is free. There are some ratings apps out there, but all of them have a price tag. But in a bit of shameless self-promotion here, development work on the WhiskeyCast iPhone app is in the final stages. It'll have all of my whiskey ratings as I add new ones, and will let you listen to the last four episodes without having to sync up to your computer. Best of all, it'll be free, thanks to support from the Glenrothes. I'll let you know when it's ready for downloading. Tom Olio's commented on the WhiskeyCast Facebook page about the plans I announced last week for the special series from Isla this coming May. He wrote, "I have a mixed feeling about Isla. I would like to shout to anyone just how wonderful it is, but on the other hand, I would like to keep this dreamlike island as long as possible secret. If you'd still be looking for a place to stay on Isla, I highly recommend the B&B of former Art Begg manager Hamish Scott and his caring wife Rona." Well, Tom, their Kaladsona, and I'm hoping I'm pronouncing that correctly, B&B, was one of the first places I checked. Unfortunately, it's already booked up for the week of the Isla Festival. However, I have added a link on the resources page of the WhiskeyCast website for anyone to use if you're planning a trip to Isla. Finally, this wasn't an official Facebook page post, but couldn't resist mentioning it. Lavinia Turnbull of the UK is a regular listener and posted this on her Facebook page the other day. "Yesterday, one of my goldfish looked like it was on its last fin, would not move at all, even if poked. Took it from tank and put it in a pan of water. Added a half teaspoon of Mortlach 15. Today, he is back in his tank swimming about quite happily. Whiskey truly is the water of life." Of course, one person commented that a spoonful of Art Begg would have had it doing backflips. If you have a question or a comment, I'd love to hear from you. My email address is comments@whiskeycast.com. Time now for the calendar of events brought to you by Laphroaig. Springbank's Peter Curry will lead a tasting at the Brandy Library in New York City on the 11th. The Madison Malt Society will hold its annual celebration of American distillers on the 18th in Madison, Wisconsin. The Munich Bar and Whiskey Festival is February 19th through the 21st. Whiskey Live Tokyo is the 21st, followed by Whiskey Live London, February 26th and 27th. John Hansel's single malt tasting at Monk's Cafe in Philadelphia on March 2nd is already sold out, but there are still tickets available for Malt Advocates Whiskey Fest in Chicago on April 23rd. The Whiskey Classic is set for March 5th in Morristown, New Jersey, and Dr. Bill Lumsden of Glenmorangie and Art Begg will present a tasting at the Dundee Dell in Omaha, Nebraska, March 6th. You'll find a complete calendar of events at the WhiskeyCast website, and it's brought to you by Laphroaig Quarter Cask. Just click on the Laphroaig banner at the WhiskeyCast website to become a friend of Laphroaig and claim your own square foot of Isla. There was one distillery with a small presence at the Victoria Whiskey Festival a couple of weeks ago. In fact, you had to look pretty hard to find the table, but the Victoria Spirits folks made a big impression. The tiny distillery has been producing gin that's well-regarded in British Columbia among mixologists, but Peter Hart had a surprise to pour at the Whiskey Festival. A couple of months ago, he produced Victoria's first single malt spirit, and it's been aging in an octave size cask since then. For now, it's being called Craig Derrick Spirit after a local castle, and while it's not for sale yet, it received rave reviews that night. British Columbia is known for its wines, and the distillery started out as the old Winchester Cellars Winery before Peter Hart came on board.
As it progressed, there was an interest in doing spirits, and that's when my family got involved with the business, and we bought a still, and we're interested in making whiskey and eau de vie and other spirits, including the gin. And then so as that developed, the wine kind of fell by the wayside. There was a couple of poor years on the island here for grapes, and the prices for grapes to be brought in from the Okanagan were going up, and so we decided that we wanted to be producing local product, and so we decided just to go with the just to stick to spirits. So this is sort of the end of our transition out of wine, and now we're just getting into the whiskey, and the whiskey this year will become all local, which is going to be really fun. And then, but that's sort of how we transitioned, and now we're fully into just spirits.
How did you make the transition and learn how to do this distilling, and what training did you go through to become a distiller, basically?
I was working. There was a winemaker who was here before I was, and he'd had a little bit of training on the still, or on other stills, and then I was working with him. I worked with him for about 4 months making the gin. And I've got a background in molecular biology. I've got a master's from UVic, and I was working at the BC Cancer Agency and commuting back and forth to help out making the gin. And then it was just practice and practice on this particular still, actually, that making the gin, that I kind of got to know how the still behaves, which is, I think, important just for, you know, being able to predict what it's going to do, being able to predict how the temperatures are going to progress, knowing how what's coming off the still, how that's, you know, little tweaks to the controls of the still, how that's going to change the flavors, so that when the whiskey came along a year and a half later, it, you know, kind of had an idea of the direction I wanted it to go. Again, I'd never actually worked in another distillery. I've never made whiskey before this, so I didn't really totally know what to expect. But I had an idea from making the gin and making eau de vie, what I might expect. And when it did happen, I was like, oh, that's actually, I kind of get a feel for it. So that's sort of how it progressed. I haven't had any other formal training in distilling except for lots of practice.
Which I think is the way a lot of guys get into this. But tell me about the still, because when we were down looking at it before, this is a wood-fired still, which is very unusual these days to find. Does that add anything different to your spirit?
It is wood-fired. It takes some finesse to get to know exactly how much wood to put on and when to put it on, and it is maybe not as predictable as gas or something like that, where you flick the switch and set it where you want it. Some people have said that they can get a hint of smoke in the products, whether that's from a little bit of smoke in the room where the still is. It's hard to say, but really it's indirect heat on the pot, so there really shouldn't be any direct effect. But It has been nice to work with the wood still, for sure.
One of the things I noticed in tasting your spirit is that it has a little element of the gin to it, from being in the same room with all the botanicals and having the barrels in the same room when you're producing your gin. That adds an interesting little touch to it.
Yeah, it. Again, when I first tasted the whiskey, I didn't detect that, but I've been tasting it in this environment. When people actually walk into the distillery, everyone says, "Wow, what a beautiful smell!" And so that's from all the botanicals that there are 10 different botanicals that go into making the gin, and they really penetrate the air in the distillery. It's quite a small room. And so it doesn't surprise me that during the production of the whiskey, you know, it is open to the air at certain times when it's just pouring out of the still right into an open stainless bucket, and that I wouldn't be surprised if it did pick up just a little bit of aroma from the botanicals.
Now, one of the things you mentioned earlier was that this is going to wind up becoming an all local product. You're working with a local brewer to get your wash, but the barley's coming from outside right now, right?
Yes, currently for this first batch, we are using Canadian malted barley, but that's because there hasn't been a malting facility or a small scale malting facility in BC, let alone on the island. But over the next couple months, there's going to be a malting facility completed in Victoria. And that's going to be, so we're going to have locally grown barley, locally malted. I hope to find some local peat and experiment with that a little bit. And then it'll be brewed locally, distilled locally, and then we'll go from there. So it will be a 100% local product within the next year, we hope.
And the hard part is finding local barrels and finding a local cooperage to make it 110% local, right?
That would be fantastic to find some local barrels. There were some people actually last night at the Distillers Festival, the Whiskey Festival, that suggested that there are Gary Oaks that are cut down for construction, and they were very curious to have some idea of what Gary Oak barrels would taste like, and that would be really interesting. I'd be very interested to do that. It would be just finding somebody with the cooperage skills to put those together.
Now, you've done your first barrel, a small scale barrel, and it's going to sit for a couple of years. What's the future for your whiskey business?
Our gin is sort of has been our main product up to this point. We're going to continue with that. We're going to be experimenting with different types of barrels. We've got some larger bourbon barrels that we're going to be working with as well. We're going to be experimenting with different malts, and we're just hoping that we can. There's a lot of interesting things being done in this part of the world, and we're not confined as tightly, so we want to kind of show people. It'll mostly be through our tasting room what we're up to, what can be done with different styles of whiskey production. We might come across one that we're absolutely totally pleased by and increase the production of that. We're quite happy with the way our first distillations turned out, but that said, we're into experimentation a little bit at this point.
Peter's also producing his own bitters for local bartenders, and frankly, I can't wait to see what his whiskey tastes like as it gets older. That night in Victoria, it received compliments very similar to those for the English Whiskey Company's 3-year-old British single malt. And just by coincidence, Andrew Nelstrup from the English Whiskey Company will be my guest on the next episode of Whiskey Cast. In the What I'm Tasting This Week department, to be honest, most of what I've been tasting this week has been blind samples for the World Whiskies Awards competition, so I don't even know what I've been tasting. I did get to taste the new limited edition Beaumont Tempest, though. It's a 10-year-old cask strength bottling at 56% ABV. The nose is lightly peated with hints of brine, honey, and lemon. The taste, smoky and peppery with a touch of brine and seaweed. And the finish is long and peaty with a hint of honey. I scored the Beaumont Tempest an 87. I'll leave it at that for this episode. I have a backlog of samples to catch up on. And we'll start on the next episode. In the meantime, you can find all of my tasting notes on the WhiskeyCast website, along with links to my Twitter feed and the WhiskeyCast Facebook page, the calendar of events, the WhiskeyCast store powered by Amazon.com, and a complete archive of past episodes. The address is www.whiskeycast.com, and my email address is comments@whiskeycast.com. WhiskeyCast is a production of Cask Strength Media, copyright 2010, and comes to you from the charming, yet regrettably dry and this weekend very snow-covered town of Haddonfield, New Jersey. I'm Mark Gillespie, reminding you that when you drink, please drink responsibly. Thanks for listening.